had been an almost manically precipitant video phone technology entrepreneur. And but so, why the abrupt consumer retreat back to good old voice-only telephoning? The answer, in a kind of trivalent nutshell, is 1. Emotional stress, 2. Physical vanity, and 3. A certain queer kind of self-obliterating logic in the microeconomics of consumer high-tech. 1. It turned out that there was something terribly stressful about visual telephone interfaces that hadn't been stressful at all about voice-only interfaces. Videophone consumers seemed suddenly to realize that they'd been subject to an insidious but wholly marvelous delusion about conventional, voice-only telephony. They'd never noticed it before, the delusion. It's like it was so emotionally complex that it could be countenanced only in the context of its loss. Good old traditional audio-only phone conversations allowed you to presume that the person on the other end was paying complete attention to you, while also permitting you not to have to pay anything even close to complete attention to her. A traditional, oral-only conversation, utilizing a handheld phone whose earpiece contained only 6 little pinholes, but whose mouthpiece, rather significantly, it later seemed, contained 6^2 power or 36 little pinholes, let you enter a kind of highway hypnotic semi-attentive fugue. While conversing, you could look around the room, doodle, fine groom, peel tiny bits of dead skin away from your cuticles, compose phone pad haiku, stir things on the stove. You could even carry on a whole separate additional sign language and exaggerated facial expression type of conversation with people right there in the room with you, all while seeming to be right there attending closely to the voice on the phone. And yet, and this was the retrospectively marvelous part, even as you were dividing your attention between the phone call and all sorts of other idle little fugue-like activities, you were somehow never haunted by the suspicion that the person on the other end's attention might be similarly divided. During a traditional call, for example, as you, let's say, performed a close tactile blemish scan of your chin, you were in no way oppressed by the thought that your phone mate was, perhaps, also devoting a good percentage of her attention to a close, tactile blemish scan. It was an illusion, and the illusion was oral and orally supported. The phone line's other end's voice was dense, tightly compressed, and vectored right into your ear, enabling you to imagine that the voice's owner's attention was similarly compressed and focused, even though your own attention was not, was the thing. This bilateral illusion of unilateral attention was almost infantilely gratifying from an emotional standpoint. You got to believe you were receiving somebody's complete attention without having to return it. Regarded with the objectivity of hindsight, the illusion appears irrational, almost literally fantastic. It would be like being able both to lie and to trust other people at the same time. Video telephony rendered the fantasy insupportable. Callers now found that they had to compose the same sort of earnest, slightly over-intense listener's expression they had to compose for in-person exchanges. Those callers who out of unconscious habit succumbed to fugue-like doodling or pants crease adjustment now came off looking rude, absent-minded, or childishly self-absorbed. Callers who even more unconsciously blemish scanned or nostril explored looked up to find horrified expressions on the video faces at the other end, all of which resulted in videophonic stress. Even worse, of course, was the traumatic expulsion from Eden feeling of looking up from tracing your thumb's outline on the reminder pad, or adjusting the old unit's angle of repose in your shorts, and actually seeing your videophonic interfacee idly strip a shoelace of its gumlet as she talked to you, and suddenly realizing your whole infantile fantasy of commanding your partner's attention while you yourself got to fugue, doodle, and make little genital adjustments, was deluded and insupportable, and that you were actually commanding not one bit more attention than you were paying here. The whole attention business was monstrously stressful, video callers found. 2. And the videophonic stress was even worse if you were at all vain. That is, if you worried at all about how you looked, as in to other people. Which, all kidding aside, who doesn't? Good old oral telephone calls could be fielded without makeup, toupee, surgical prosthesis, etc. Even without clothes, if that sort of thing rattled your saber. But for the image conscious, there was, of course, no such answer-as-you-are informality about visual video telephone calls, which consumers began to see were less like having the good old phone ring than having the doorbell ring, and having to throw on clothes and attach prostheses and do hair checks in the foyer mirror before answering the door. But the real coffin nail for videophony involved the way callers' faces looked on their TP screen during calls. Not their callers' faces, but their own when they saw them on video. It was a three-button affair, after all, to use the TP's cartridge card's video record option to record both pulses in a two-way visual call and play the call back, and see how your face had actually looked to the other person during the call. This sort of appearance check was no more resistible than a mirror, but the experience proved almost universally horrifying. People were horrified at how their own faces appeared on a TP screen. It wasn't just Anchorman's bloat, that well-known impression of extra weight that video inflicts on the face. It was worse. Even with high-end TP's high-def viewer screens, consumers perceived something essentially blurred and moist-looking about their phone faces. A shiny, pallid indefiniteness that struck them as not just unflattering, but somehow evasive, furtive, untrustworthy, unlikable. In an early and ominous Interlace/GTE focus group survey that was all but ignored in a storm of entrepreneurial sci-fi tech enthusiasm, almost 60% of respondents who received visual access to their own faces during videophonic calls specifically used the terms untrustworthy, unlikable, or hard to like in describing their own visage's appearance, with a phenomenally ominous 71% of senior citizen respondents specifically comparing their video faces to that of Richard Nixon during the Nixon-Kennedy debates of B.S. 1960. The proposed solution to what the telecommunications industry's psychological consultants termed video physiognomic dysphoria, or VPD, was of course the advent of high-definition masking. And in fact, it was those entrepreneurs who gravitated toward the production of high-definition videophonic imaging and then outright masks who got in and out of the short-lived videophonic era with their shirts plus solid additional nets. Mask-wise, the initial option of high-definition photographic imaging, that is, taking the most flattering elements of a variety of flattering multi-angle photos of a given phone consumer and, thanks to existing image configuration equipment already pioneered by the cosmetics and law enforcement industries, combining them into a wildly attractive high-def broadcastable composite of a face wearing an earnest, slightly over-intense expression of complete attention, was quickly supplanted by the more inexpensive and bite-economical option of, using the exact same cosmetic and FBI software, actually casting the enhanced facial image in a form-fitting polybutylene resin mask. And consumers soon found that the high upfront cost of a permanent wearable mask was more than worth it, considering the stress and VPD reduction benefits. And the convenient Velcro straps for the back of the mask and caller's head cost peanuts. And for a couple fiscal quarters, phone/cable companies were able to rally VPD-afflicted consumers' confidence by working out a horizontally integrated deal where free composite and masking services came with a video phone hookup. The high-def masks were not in use, simply hung on a small hook on the side of a TP's phone console. Admittedly, looking maybe a bit surreal and discomforting when detached and hanging there empty and wrinkled, and sometimes there were potentially awkward mistaken identity snafus involving multi-user family or company phones, and the hurried selection and attachment of the wrong mask taken from some long row of empty hanging masks. But all in all, the masks seemed initially like a viable industry response to the vanity, stress, and Nixonian facial image problem. Two, and maybe also three, but combine the natural entrepreneurial instinct to satisfy all sufficiently high consumer demand on the one hand, with what appears to be an almost equally natural distortion in the way persons tend to see themselves, and it becomes possible to account historically for the speed with which the whole high-def, videophonic mask thing spiraled totally out of control. Not only is it weirdly hard to evaluate what you yourself look like whether you're good-looking or not. For example, try looking in the mirror and determining where you stand in the attractiveness hierarchy with anything like the objective ease you can determine whether just about anyone else you know is good-looking or not. But it turned out that consumers' instinctively skewed self-perception, plus vanity-related stress, meant that they began preferring and then outright demanding video phone masks that were really quite a lot better looking than they themselves were in person. High-def mask entrepreneurs, ready and willing to supply not just verisimilitude but aesthetic enhancement, stronger chins, smaller eye bags, airbrushed scars and wrinkles, soon pushed the original mimetic mask entrepreneurs right out of the market. In a gradually unsubtilizing progression, within a couple more sales quarters, most consumers were now using masks so undeniably better looking on video phones than their real faces were in person, transmitting to one another such horrendously skewed and enhanced masked images of themselves, that enormous psychosocial stress began to result. Large numbers of phone users suddenly reluctant to leave home and interface personally with people who, they feared, were now habituated to seeing their far better looking masked selves on the phone and would, on seeing them in person, suffer, so went the caller's phobia, the same illusion-shattering aesthetic disappointment that, for example, certain women who always wear makeup give people the first time they ever see them without makeup. The social anxiety surrounding the phenomenon psych consultants termed optimistically misrepresentational masking, or OMM, intensified steadily as the tiny, crude first-generation videophone camera's technology improved to where the aperture wasn't as narrow. And now, the higher-end, tiny cameras could countenance and transmit more or less full-body images. Certain psychologically unscrupulous entrepreneurs began marketing full-body polybutylene and urethane 2D cutouts. Sort of like the headless muscle man and bathing beauty cutouts you could stand behind and position your chin on the cardboard neck stump of for cheap photos at the beach. Only these full-body videophone masks were vastly more high-tech and convincing-looking. Once you added variable 2D wardrobe, hair and eye color options, various aesthetic enlargements and reductions, etc., costs started to press the envelope of mass market affordability, even though there was, at the same time, horrific social pressure to be able to afford the very best possible masked 2D body image to keep from feeling comparatively hideous looking on the phone. How long, then, could one expect it to have been before the relentless entrepreneurial drive toward an ever-better mousetrap conceived of the transmittable tableau, also known as TT, which in retrospect was probably the really sharp business end of the videophonic coffin nail. With TTs, facial and bodily masking could now be dispensed with altogether and replaced with the video-transmitted image of what was essentially a heavily doctored still photograph, one of an incredibly fit and attractive and well-turned-out human being, someone who actually resembled you, the caller, only in such limited respects as, like, race and limb number. The photo's face focused attentively in the direction of the videophonic camera from amid the sumptuous but not ostentatious appointments of the sort of room that best reflected the image of yourself you wanted to transmit, etc. The tableaus were simply high-quality transmission-ready photographs, scaled down to diorama-like proportions and fitted with a plastic holder over the videophone camera, not unlike a lens cap. Extremely good-looking but not terrifically successful entertainment celebrities, the same sort who in decades past would have swelled the cast lists of infomercials, found themselves in demand as models for various high-end videophone tableaus. Because they involved simple transmission-ready photography, instead of computer imaging and enhancement, the tableaus could be mass-produced and commensurately priced, and for a brief time they helped ease the tension between the high cost of enhanced body masking and the monstrous aesthetic pressures videophony exerted on callers, not to mention also providing employment for set designers, photographers, airbrushers, and infomercial-level celebrities hard-pressed by the declining fortunes of broadcast television advertising. 3. But there's some sort of revealing lesson here in the beyond short-term viability curve of advances in consumer technology. The career of videophony conforms neatly to this curve's classically annular shape. First, there's some sort of terrific sci-fi-like advance in consumer tech, like from oral to videophoning, which advance always, however, has certain unforeseen disadvantages for the consumer, and then, but the market niches created by those disadvantages, like people's stressfully vain repulsion at their own videophonic appearance, are ingeniously filled via sheer entrepreneurial verve. And yet, the very advantages of these ingenious disadvantage compensations seem all too often to undercut the original high-tech advance, resulting in consumer recidivism and curve closure and massive shirt loss for precipitant investors. In the present case, the stress and vanity compensation's own evolution saw video callers rejecting first their own faces and then even their own heavily masked and enhanced physical likenesses, and finally covering the video cameras altogether and transmitting attractively stylized static tableaus to one another's TPs. And behind these lens cap dioramas and transmitted tableaus, callers, of course, found that they were once again stresslessly invisible, unvainly makeup and toupee-less and baggy-eyed behind their celebrity dioramas, once again free, since once again unseen, to doodle, blemish scan, manicure, crease check, while on their screen the attractive, intensely attentive face of the well-appointed celebrity on the other end's tableau reassured them that they were the objects of a concentrated attention they themselves didn't have to exert. And of course, but these advantages were nothing other than the once lost and now appreciated advantages of good old Bell-era, blind, oral-only telephoning, with its 6 and 6 to the 2nd power pinholes. The only difference was that now these expensive, silly, unreal, stylized tableaus were being transmitted between TPs on high-priced video fiber lines. How much time, after this realization sank in and spread among consumers, mostly via phone, interestingly, would any microeconometrist expect a need to pass before high-tech visual videophony was mostly abandoned? A return to good old telephoning not only dictated by common consumer sense, but actually after a while culturally approved as a kind of chic integrity. Not Ludditism, but a kind of retrograde transcendence of sci-fi-ish high-tech for its own sake, a transcendence of the vanity and the slavery to high-tech fashion that people view as so unattractive in one another. In other words, a return to oral-only telephony became, at the closed curve's end, a kind of status symbol of anti-vanity, such that only colors utterly lacking in self-awareness continue to use videophony and tableaus, to say nothing of masks, and these tacky, facsimile-using people became ironic cultural symbols of tacky, vain slavery to corporate PR and high-tech novelty, became the subsidized era's tacky equivalents of people with leisure suits, black velvet paintings, sweater vests for their poodles, electric zirconium jewelry, no-coat lingua scrapers, and sea. Most communications consumers put their tableaus, dioramas, at the back of a knick-knack shelf and covered their cameras with standard black lens caps, and now use their phone console's little mask hooks to hang these new little plasticine address and phone diaries, specially made with a little receptacle at the top of the binding for convenient hanging from former mask hooks. Even then, of course, the bulk of U.S. consumers remained verifiably reluctant to leave home and telepewter and to interface personally. Though this phenomenon's endurance can't be attributed to the telephony fad per se, and anyway, the new panagoraphobia served to open huge new entrepreneurial, telepewterized markets for home shopping and delivery, and didn't cause much industry concern. Four times per annum in these chemically troubled times, the Organization of North American Nations Tennis Association's Juniors Division sends a young toxicologist with corn silk hair and a smooth, wide button of a nose and a blue ONANTA blazer to collect urine samples from any student at any accredited tennis academy ranked higher than number 64 continentally in his or her age division. Competitive junior tennis is meant to be good, clean fun. It's October, in the year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. An impressive percentage of the kids at ETA are in their division's top 64. On urine sample day, the juniors form two long lines that trail out of the locker rooms and up the stairs and then run agnet and co-ed across the ETA ComEd building lobby with its royal blue shag and hardwood paneling and great glass cases of trophies and plaques. It takes about an hour to get from the middle of the line to your sex's locker room stall area, where either the blonde young toxicologist, or on the girl's side, a nurse whose severe widow's peak tops her square face with a sort of bisected forehead, dispenses a plastic cup with a pale green lid and a strip of white medical tape with a name and a monthly ranking and 10, 15, YDAU, and ETA, neatly printed in a 6-point font. Probably about a fourth of the ranking players over, say, 15 at the Enfield Tennis Academy cannot pass a standard North American GCMS urine scan.
52.
These, 17-year-old Michael Pemulis's nighttime customers, now become also, four times yearly, his daytime customers. Clean urine is 10 adjusted dollars a cc. Get your urine here! Pemulis and Trevor Axford become quarterly urine vendors. They wear those papery oval caps ballpark vendors wear. They spend 3 months collecting and stashing the urine of sub-10-year-old players, warm, pale, innocent, childish urine that's produced in needly little streams, and the only GM scan it couldn't pass would be like an Ovaltine scan or something. Then, every third month, Pemulis and Axford work the agnet unsupervised line that snakes across the blue lobby shag, selling little Visine bottles of urine out of an antique vendor's tub for ballpark wieners, snagged for a song from a Fenway Park wiener man fallen on hard off-season times. A big old box of dull, dimpled tin with a strap in socks colors that goes around the back of the neck and keeps the vendor's hands free to make change. Urine! Clinically sterile urine! Piping hot! Urine you'd be proud to take home and introduce to the folks. Trevor Axford handles cash flow. Pemulis dispenses little conical-tipped Visine bottles of juvenile urine, bottles easily rendered discreet in underarm, sock, or panty. You're in trouble? You're in luck. Quarterly sales breakdowns indicate slightly more male customers than female customers for urine. Tomorrow morning, ETA custodial workers, Kenkel and Brandt, or Dave fall down very hard, the well-loved old janitor laid off from Boston College for contracting narcolepsy, or thick-ankled Irish women from the semi-tenements down the hill across Commonwealth Avenue, or else sullen and shifty-eyed residents from Ennett House, the halfway facility at the bottom of the hill's other side in the old VA hospital complex, hard-looking and generally sullen types who come and do 9 months of menial work for the 32 hours a week their treatment contract requires, will empty scores of little empty plastic Visine bottles from sub-dorm wastebaskets into the dumpster nest behind the ETA employee parking lot, from which dumpsters Pemulis will then get Mario Incandenza and some of the naiver of the original ephebic urine donators themselves to remove, sterilize, and rebox the bottles under the guise of a rousing game of who can find, boil, and box the most empty Visine bottles in a 3-hour period without any kind of authority figure knowing what you're up to? A game which Mario found thumpingly weird when Pemulis introduced it to him 3 years ago, but which Mario's really come to look forward to since he's found he has a real sort of mystical intuitive knack for finding Visine bottles and the sedimentary layers of packed dumpsters, and always seems to win hands down. And if you're poor old Mario Incandenza, you take your competitive strokes where you can find them. T. Axford then stashes and recycles the bottles, and packaging overhead is nil. He and Pemulis keep the wiener tub stashed under a discarded Yarmouth sail in the back of the used tow truck they'd chipped in on with Hal and Jim Strzok and another guy who's since graduated ETA and now plays for Pepperdine, and paid to have reconditioned and the rusty chain and hook that hung from the tow truck's back-tilted derrick replaced with a gleamingly new chain and thick hook, which get used really only twice a year, spring and late fall, for brief intervals of short-distance hauling during the all-weather lungs dismantling and erection, plus occasionally pulling a paralyzed rear-wheel drive student or employee vehicle either back onto or all the way up the ETA hillside's long 70-foot driveway during bad snowstorms. And the whole thing de-rusted and painted in ETA's proud red and gray school colors, with a complex O-N-A-N heraldic ensign, a snarling full-front eagle with a broom and a can of disinfectant in one claw and a maple leaf in the other, and wearing a sombrero and appearing to have about half-eaten a swatch of star-studded cloth, rather ironically silkscreened under the driver's side door, and the good old pre-Tavis ETA traditional motto, te occidere possunt, te edere non possunt, ne fossest, unironically emblazoned on the passenger door, and which they all share use of, though Pemulis and Axford get slight priority, because the truck's registration and basic liability insurance get paid for out of quarterly urine revenues. Hal's older brother Mario, who, by dean of students' fiat, gets to bunk in a double with Hal in subdorm A on the third floor of ComEd, even though he's too physically challenged even to play low-level recreational tennis, but who's keenly interested in video and film cartridge production and pulls his weight as part of the ETA community, recording assigned sections of matches and drills and processional stroke filming sessions for later playback and analysis by Stitt and his staff, is filming the congregated line and social interactions and vending operation of the Urine Day lobby, using his strap-attached head-mounted camera and thoracic police lock and foot treadle, apparently getting footage for one of the short, strange, himself-influenced conceptual cartridges the administration lets him occupy his time making and futzing around with down in the late founder's editing and FX facilities off the main sub-ComEd tunnel. And Pemulis and Axford do not object to the filming, Nor do they even do that hand-to-temple face-obscuring thing when he aims the head-mounted Bolex their way, since they know nobody will end up seeing the footage except Mario himself, and that at their request he'll modulate and scramble the vendors and customers' faces into undulating systems of flesh-colored squares by means of his late father's reconfiguring matte panel in the editing room, since facial scrambling will heighten whatever weird conceptual effect Mario's usually after anyway. Though also because Mario's notoriously fond of undulating flesh-colored squares and will jump at any opportunity to edit them in over people's faces. They do brisk business. Michael Pemulis, wiry, pointy-featured, phenomenally talented at net, but about two steps too slow to get up there effectively against high-level pace, so in compensation also a great offensive lob man, is a scholarship student from right nearby in Alston, Massachusetts. A grim section of tract housing and vacant lots, low-rise Greek and Irish housing projects, gravel and haphazard sewage, and indifferent municipal upkeep, a lot of depressed petrochemical light industry all along the spur, an outlying district zoned for sprawl. An old joke in Enfield, Brighton goes, "Kiss me where it smells," she said. So I took her to Alston, where he discovered a knack playing boys' club tennis in cut-off shorts and no shirt, and a store-strung stick on scuzzy courts with blacktop that discolored your yellow balls, and nets made of spare Feeney Park fencing that sent net-cord shots spronging all the way out into traffic. An inner-city development program tennis prodigy at 10, recruited up the hill at 11, with parents who wanted to know how much ETA'd pay up front for rights to all future possible income. Cavalier about practice, but a bundle of strangled nerves in tournaments, the rap on Pemulis is that he's way lower ranked than he could be with a little hard work, since he's not only ETA's finest eschatonic marksman off the lob, but Stitz says is the one youth here now who knows truly what it is to punch the volley.
53.
Pemulis, whose pre-ETA home life was apparently hackle-raising, also sells small-time drugs of distinguished potency at reasonable retail prices to a large pie slice of the total junior tournament circuit market. Mario Incandenza is one of those people who wouldn't see the point of trying recreational chemicals even if he knew how to go about it. He just wouldn't get it. His smile, below the Bolex camera strapped to his large but sort of withered-looking head, is constant and broad, as he films the line's serpentine movement against glass shelves full of prizes. M. Pemulis, whose middle name is Matthew, has the highest Stanford Binet of any kid on academic probation ever at the academy. Hal Incandenza's most valiant efforts barely get Pemulis through Mrs. I's triad of required grammars.
54.
And Soma R.L.O. Chawaf's heady literature of discipline. Because Pemulis, who claims he sees every third word upside down, actually just has a born tech science weenie's congenital impatience with the referential murkiness and inelegance of verbal systems. His early tennis promise, quick peaking, and it's turned out to be a bit dilettantish. Pemulis's real enduring gift is for math and hard science, and his scholarship is the coveted James O. Incandenza Geometrical Optics Scholarship, of which there is only one, and which each term Pemulis manages to avoid losing by just one dentodermal layer of overall GPA, and which gives him sanctioned access to all the late director's lenses and equipment, some of which turn out to be useful to unrelated enterprises. Mario's the only other person sharing the optic and editing labs off the main tunnel, and the two have the kind of transpersonal bond that shared interests and mutual advantage can inspire. If Mario's not helping Pemulis fabricate the products of independent optical study work MP isn't really much into doing, you should see the boy with a convex lens, Avril likes to say within Mario's hearing. He's like a fish in brine. Then Pemulis is giving Mario, who's a film nut but no great tech mind, serious help with cinemo-optical praxis, the physics of focal length and reflective compounds, You should see Pamulus with an emulsion curve, yawning blasély under his bill-reversed yachting hat and scratching an armpit, juggling differentials like a boy born to wear a pocket protector and high-water corduroys and electrician's tape on his horn-rims temples, asking Mario if he knows what you call three Canadians copulating on a snowmobile. Mario and his brother Hal both consider Pamulus a good friend, though friendship at ETA is non-negotiable currency. Hal in Cadenza for a long time identified himself as a lexical prodigy who, though Avril had taken pains to let all three of her children know that her non-judgmental love and pride depended in no way on achievement or performance or potential talent, had made his mother proud, plus a really good tennis player. Hal in Cadenza is now being encouraged to identify himself as a late-blooming prodigy and possible genius at tennis, who is on the verge of making every authority figure in his world and beyond very proud indeed. He's never looked better on court or on monthly ONANTA paper. He is irrumpant. He has made what Schitt termed a leap of exponents at a post-pubescent age when radical, plateaus-hopping, near J. Wayne and show caliber improvement is extraordinarily rare in tennis. He gets his sterile urine gratis, though he could well afford to pay. Pamulus depends on him for verbal academic support and dislikes owing favors, even to friends. Hal is, at 17, as of 10 YDAU, judged ex cathedra the fourth best tennis player under age 18 in the United States of America, and the sixth best on the continent, by those athletic organizing bodies duly charged with the task of ranking. Hal's head, closely monitored by DeLint and staff, is judged still level and focused and unswollen slash bludgeoned by the sudden éclat and rise in general expectations. When asked how he's doing with it all, Hal says, fine, and thanks you for asking. If Hal fulfills this newly emergent level of promise and makes it all the way up to the show, Mario will be the only one of the in Cadenza children not wildly successful as a professional athlete. No one who knows Mario could imagine that this fact would ever even occur to him. Orin, Mario, and Hal's late father was revered as a genius in his original profession without anybody ever realizing what he really turned out to be a genius at, even he himself, at least not while he was alive, which is perhaps bona fidely tragic, but also, as far as Mario is concerned, ultimately all right, if that's the way things unfolded. Certain people find people like Mario in Cadenza irritating, or even think they're outright bats, dead inside in some essential way. Michael Pemulus's basic posture with people is that Mrs. Pemulus raised no dewy-eyed fools. He wears painter's caps on court and sometimes a yachting cap turned around 180 degrees, and, since he's not ranked high enough to get any free corporate clothing offers, plays in t-shirts with things like Alston HS Wolf Spiders and Choosy Mothers and The Fiends in Human Shape YDAU Tour, or, like an ancient, can you believe it, the Supreme Court just desecrated our flag on them. His face is the sort of spiky-featured, brow-dominated Fenian face you see all over Irish Alston and Brighton, its chin and nose sharp, and skin the natal brown color of the shell of a quality nut. Michael Pemulus is nobody's fool, and he fears the dealer's Brutus, the potential eater of cheese, the rat, the wiretap, the pubescent-looking finest sent to make him look foolish. So when somebody calls his room's phone, even on video, and wants to buy some sort of substance, they have to right off the bat utter the words, please commit a crime. And Michael Pemulus will reply, gracious me and mine, a crime you say? And the customer has to insist right over the phone and say he'll pay Michael Pemulus money to commit a crime. Or like that he'll harm Michael Pemulus in some way if he refuses to commit a crime. And Michael Pemulus will, in a clear an ideable voice, make an appointment to see the caller in person to plead for my honor and personal safety, so that if anybody eats cheese later, or the phone's frequency is covertly accessed somehow, Pemulus will have been entrapped.
55.
Secreting a small Visine bottle of urine in an armpit in line also brings it up to plausible temperature. At the entrance to the male stall area, the ephebic-looking ONANTA toxicologist rarely even looks up from his clipboard. But the square-faced nurse can be a problem over on the female side because every so often, she'll want the stall door open during production. With Jim Strzok handling published source plagiarism and compressed iteration and xerography, Pemulus also offers, at reasonable cost, a small Vade Mecum-ish pamphlet detailing several methods for dealing with this contingency. Winter, B.S., 1960, Tucson, Arizona.
Jim, not that way, Jim. That's no way to treat a garage door, bending stiffly down at the waist and yanking at the handle so the door jerks up and out, jerky and hard, and you crack your shins and my ruined knees, son. Let's see you bend at the healthy knees. Let's see you hook a soft hand lightly over the handle, feeling its subtle grain, and pull just as exactly gently as will make it come to you. Experiment, Jim. See just how much force you need to start the door easy. Let it roll up, out open, on its hidden greasy rollers and pulleys in the ceiling set of spiderweb beams. Think of all garage doors as the well-oiled open-out door of a broiler with hot meat in, heat roiling out hot. Needless and dangerous ever to yank, pull, shove, thrust. Your mother is a shover and a thruster, son. She treats bodies outside herself without respect or due care. She's never learned that treating things in the gentlest, most relaxed way is also treating them and your own body in the most efficient way. It's Marlon Brando's fault, Jim. Your mother back in California before you were born, before she became a devoted mother and long-suffering wife and breadwinner, son, your mother had a bit part in a Marlon Brando movie. Her big moment. Had to stand there in saddle shoes and bobby socks and ponytail and put her hands over her ears as really loud motorbikes roared by. A major thespian moment, believe you me. She was in love from afar with his fellow Marlon Brando, son. Who? Who? Jim, Marlon Brando was the archetypal new type actor who ruined, it looks like, two whole generations' relations with their own bodies and everyday objects and bodies around them. No? Well, it was because of Brando you were opening that garage door like that, Jimbo. The disrespect gets learned and passed on, passed down. You'll know Brando when you watch him, and you'll have learned to fear him. Brando, Jim. Jesus. B-R-A-N-D-O. Brando, the new archetypal tough guy rebel and slob type, leaning back on his chair's rear legs, coming crooked through doorways, slouching against everything in sight, trying to dominate objects, showing no artful respect or care, yanking things toward him like a moody child, and using them up and tossing them crudely aside so they miss the wastebasket and just lie there, ill-used. With the over-clumsy, impetuous movements and postures of a moody infant. Your mother is one of that new generation that moves against life's grain, across its warp and baffles. She may have loved Marlon Brando, Jim, but she didn't understand him. Is what's ruined her for everyday arts like broilers and garage doors and even low-level public park knock-around tennis. Ever see your mother with a broiler door? It's carnage, Jim. It's to cringe to see it. And the poor dumb thing thinks it's tribute to this slouching slob type she loved as he roared by. Jim, she never intuited the gentle and cunning economy behind this man's, quote, harsh, sloppy, unstudied approach to objects. The way he'd, oh so clearly, practiced a chair's back leg tilt over and over.
The way he studied objects with a welder's eye for those strongest centered seams,
which, when pressured by the swinishest slouch, still support. She never sees that Marlon Brando felt himself as body so keenly he'd no need for manner. She never sees that in his, quote, careless way, he actually really touched whatever he touched as if it were part of him, of his own body. The world he only seemed to manhandle was, for him, sentient, feeling. And no one, and she, never understood that. Sour, sodding grapes indeed. You can't envy someone who can be that way. Respect, maybe. Maybe wistful respect at the very outside. She never saw that Brando was playing the equivalent of high-level quality tennis across sound stages all over both coasts, Jim, is what he was really doing. Jim, he moved like a careless fingerling, one big muscle, muscularly naive, but always notice, a fingerling at the center of a clear current. That kind of animal grace, the bastard wasted no motion, is what made it art, this brutish no care. His was a tennis player's dictum. Touch things with consideration, and they will be yours. You will own them. They will move or stay still or move for you. They will lie back and part their legs and yield up their innermost seams to you. Teach you all their tricks. He knew what the beats know,
and what the great tennis player knows, son.
Learn to do nothing with your whole head and body, and everything will be done by what's around you.
I know you don't understand, yet. I know that goggle-eyed stare.
I know what it means all too well, son.
It's no matter.
You will. Jim, I know what I know. I'm predicting it right here, young Sir Jim. You are going to be a great tennis player. I was near great. You will be truly great. You will be the real thing. I know I haven't taught you to play yet. I know this is your first time, Jim. Jesus, relax, I know. It doesn't affect my predictive sense. You will overshadow and obliterate me. Today, you are starting, and within a very few years, I know all too well you will be able to beat me out there, and on the day you first beat me, I may well weep. It'll be out of a sort of selfless pride, an obliterated father's terrible joy. I feel it, Jim, even here, standing on hot gravel and looking. In your eyes, I see the appreciation of angle.
Prescience, ray, spin.
The way you already adjust your overlarge and apparently clumsy child's body in the chair so it's at the line of best force against dish, spoon, lens grinding appliance, a big book's stiff bend. You do it unconsciously. You have no idea, but I watch very closely. Don't ever think I don't, son. You will be poetry in motion, Jim, size and posture and all. Don't let the posture problem fool you about your true potential out there. Take it from me for a change. The trick will be transcending that overlarge head, son. Learning to move just the way you already sit still, living in your body.
This is the communal garage, son.
And this is our door in the garage. I know you know. I know you've looked at it before many times. Now see it, Jim. See it as body. The dull-colored handle, the clockwise latch, the bits of bug trapped when the paint was wet and now still protruding.
The cracks from this merciless sunlight out here. Original color, anyone's guess, boyo.
The concave inlaid squares, how many? Beveled at how many levels at the borders that pass for decoration? Count the squares, maybe. Let's see you treat this door like a lady, son. Twisting the latch clockwise with one hand, that's right, and I guess you'll have to pull harder, Jim. Maybe even harder than that. Now, let me. Yep, that's the way she wants doing, Jim. Have a look. Jim, this is where we keep this 1956 Mercury Montclair you know so well. This Montclair weighs 3,900 pounds, give or take. It has 8 cylinders and a canted windshield and aerodynamic fins, Jim. It has a maximum flat-out road speed of 95 mph per. I described the shade of the paint job of this Montclair to the dealer when I first saw it as bit lip red. Jim, it's a machine. It will do what it's made for and do it perfectly, but only when stimulated by someone who's made it his business to know its tricks and seams as a body. The stimulator of this car must know the car, Jim, feel it, be inside much more than just the compartment. It's an object, Jim, a body. But don't let it fool you, sitting here mute. It will respond, if given its due, with artful care. It's a body, and will respond with a well-oiled purr once I get some decent oil in her, and all mercury-ish add up to 95 big ones purr for just that driver who treats its body like his own, who feels the big steel body he's inside, who quietly and unnoticed feels the nubbly plastic of the grip of the shift up next to the wheel when he shifts, just as he feels the skin and flesh, the muscle and sinew and bone wrapped in gray spiderwebs of nerves in the blood-fed hand, just as he feels the plastic and metal and flange and teeth, the pistons and rubber and rods of the amber-fueled Montclair when he shifts. The bodily red of a well-bit lip parping along at a silky 80-plus purr. Jim, a toast to our knowledge of bodies. To high-level tennis and the road of life. Son, you're 10. And this is hard news for somebody 10, even if you're almost 5'11", a possible pituitary freak. Son, you're a body, son. That quick little scientific prodigy's mind she's so proud of and won't quit twittering about. Son, it's just neural spasms. Those thoughts in your mind are just the sound of your head revving. And head is still just body, Jim. Commit this to memory. Head is body. Jim, brace yourself against my shoulders here for this hard news at 10. You're a machine, a body, an object, Jim, no less than this redolent Montclair. This coil of hose here, or that rake there for the front yard's gravel, or sweet Jesus, this nasty fat spider flexing in its web over there up next to the rake handle. See it? See it? Latro Dectus Mactans, Jim. Widow. Grab this racket and move gracefully and feelingly over there and kill that widow for me, young Sir Jim. Go on. Make it say K. Take no names. There's a lad. Here's to a spiderless section of communal garage. Bodies, bodies everywhere. A tennis ball is the ultimate body, kid. We're coming to the crux of what I have to try to impart to you before we get out there and start actuating this fearsome potential of yours. Jim, a tennis ball is the ultimate body. Perfectly round. Even distribution of mass, but empty inside. Utterly a vacuum. Susceptible to whim, spin, to force, used well or poorly. It will reflect your own character, characterless itself, pure potential. Have a look at a ball. Get a ball from the cheap green plastic laundry basket of old used balls I keep there by the propane torches and use to practice the occasional serve, Jimbo. Attaboy. Now, look at the ball. Heft it. Feel the weight. Here, I'll, tear the ball open. See? Nothing in there but evacuated air that smells like a kind of rubber hell. Empty. Pure potential. Notice I tore it open along the seam. It's a body. You'll learn to treat it with consideration, son. Some might say a kind of love, and it will open for you. Do your bidding, be at your beck and soft lover's call. The thing truly great players with hale bodies who overshadow all others have is a way with the ball that's called, and keep in mind the garage door and broiler, touch. Touch the ball. Now that's the touch of a player right there. And as with the ball, so with that big, thin, slumped, overtall body, Sir Jimbo. I'm predicting it right now. I see the way you'll apply the lessons of today to yourself as a physical body. No more carrying your head at the level of your chest under round, slumped shoulders. No more tripping up. No more overshot reaches, shattered plates, tilted lampshades, slumped shoulders, and caved-in chest. The simplest objects twisting and resistant in your big, thin hands, boy. Imagine what it feels like to be this ball, Jim. Total physicality. No revving head. Complete presence. Absolute potential, sitting there potentially absolute in your big, pale, slender, girlish hand, so young its thumbs unwrinkled at the joint.
My thumb's wrinkled at the joint, Jim. Some might say gnarled. Have a look at this thumb right here.
But I still treat it as my own. I give it its due. You want a drink of this, son? I think you're ready for a drink of this. No? Nine? Today, lesson one out there, you become, for better or worse, Jim, a man, a player. A body in commerce with bodies.
A helmsman at your own vessel's tiller. A machine in the ghost, to quote a phrase.
A 10-year-old, freakishly tall, bow-tied and thick-bespeckled citizen of the... I drink this sometimes when I'm not actively working to help me accept the same painful things it's now time for me to tell you, son. Jim, are you ready? I'm telling you this now because you have to know what I'm about to tell you if you're going to be the more than near-great top-level tennis player I know you're going to be eventually very soon. Brace yourself. Son, get ready. It's gloriously painful. Have just maybe a taste here. This flask is silver. Treat it with due care. Feel its shape. The near soft feel of the warm silver and the calfskin sheath that covers only half its flat, rounded silver length. An object that rewards a considered touch. Feel the slippery heat. That's the oil from my fingers. My oil, Jim. From my body. Not my hand, son. Feel the flask. Heft it. Get to know it. It's an object, a vessel. It's a 2-pint flask full of amber liquid. Actually, more like half full, it seems. So it seems.
This flask has been treated with due care. It's never been dropped or jostled or crammed. It's never had an errant drop. Not drop one spilled out of it.
I treat it as if it can feel. I give it its due as a body. Unscrew the cap. Hold the calfskin sheath in your right hand and use your good left hand to feel the cap's shape and ease it around on the threads. Son, you'll have to put that, what is that? That Columbia Guide to Refractive Indices second edition down, son. Looks heavy anyway.
A tendon strainer.
Fuck up your pronator teres and surrounding tendons before you even start.
You're gonna have to put down the book for once, young Sir Jimbo.
You never try to handle two objects at the same time without just eons of diligent practice and care. A Brando-like
you don't just drop the book, son. You don't just don't drop the big old guide to indices on the dusty garage floor so it raises a square bloom of dust and